What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another fantastic edition of the Athletic Hockey Show, the Wednesday Roundtable edition, where we take all the big stories from the week, discuss them, argue them, prod them, poke them, do everything we can. I am Rob Pizel from CBC Sports, joined as always by Jesse Granger, who's in Vegas. How are you, Jesse? We have a new co-host. We teased it last week like we were some sort of wrestling promotion or something, like the secret man who's going to join our crew. Well, that secret man is now with us. Usually, he's all things Minnesota Wild with us. He's going to be all things everything. Michael Russo from The Athletic, our new co-host for the upcoming 2022-2023 season. Welcome to the show, sir.
Well, thank you, guys. You know, it's funny. I teased Joe Smith coming to Minnesota to help me for about... 3 weeks. So this is probably nothing for people, but I'm excited about a new role at The Athletic, doing a lot more national stuff, but also keeping my eyes on the Wild, because, you know, as Jeff Domet, our illustrious producer, knows, there's certain people that are just sort of wired to be beat writers, and there's no way I'll be able to ever unplug that. But I'm really excited to work with Joe Smith here and have him also do national stuff and us tag team the Wild, and then getting to do stuff like this with you guys and keep Straight from the Source, my Minnesota Wild podcast, up and running. But this is going to be a blast. I've watched and been part of the show at times, but I've watched the show a million times, listened to the show a million times. And now to be on it with you two, it's going to be just a great, great experience.
All right, you already broke a rule. You said Jeff is illustrious. we have a rule where you just don't compliment Jeff.
Yeah, Jeff has been sending me text messages for about 20 years. Hey, can you come on this channel? So I've known Jeff for a long time, and we finally actually got to meet in person at the draft. But it's funny, you meet somebody like Jeff, and you're like, I feel like I've known you for 20 years, yeah. But it was actually the first time we actually got to like give each other a hug, so it was pretty cool.
So yeah, we're going to get together every week. Michael Russo now joining the team. Jesse, as always, will be here, and we're going to hit everything. And we got a lot of talkers. So you know what, guys, today, no guests today, the three of us, let's get used to being on the same line. I don't know who's the centerman, who's the winger, and Jesse's always the goalie. He wants to be the guy between the pipes. But we are not going to start with goaltenders. We're going to start with Jordan Kyrou. Big news this week, 8 years, $65 million extension with the Blues. 23 years old, set career highs with goals, 27, 45 assists, 75 points. Your initial thoughts on this one, guys, because the Blues are making a habit of 8-year deals for players fresh off the Thomas one, but we'll start with the newbie, the rookie, Mr. Russo. What'd you think?
Well, I was stunned at the price, other than the fact that guys like, you know, Elliot Friedman, Andy Strickland have been sort of teasing this for a while, that it was going to be 8 years of big time money. And obviously this is another projection contract. We just saw with Stützle in Ottawa. And this is sort of the new realm in the NHL of everybody. I mean, there's been so many 8-year deals this summer, and it kind of started with Erickson Ek getting an 8-year deal at an incredible price last year, a little north of $5 million here in Minnesota. But Kyrou, they believe he's going to be a star. Dom put out all the analytics the other day here at The Athletic, and how it looks like he's absolutely on that path. And look, if he could play the Minnesota Wild outdoors at the Winter Classic every year, he'll score about 100 goals a season. That probably won't happen, but he just looks to me like they obviously believe he's going to be a stud, and we'll see if he could reach that point. He's going to get a lot more time with David Perron now, a lot more responsibility with David Perron gone. He'll get more power play time, and I just think it to be in a top six role to give him this money, they clearly are going to give him all the responsibility in the world over this next, not just short term, but long term.
Before we get to Jesse, so Kyrou, Stützle, Huberdeau, Tkachuk, Norris, Sergachev, Sorelli, Chernak, Thomas, Nikushkin, and Forsberg. Crazy. I was reading those fast because there are so many, all 8-year deals this summer, which is just crazy. Jesse, what'd you think?
Yeah, Michael kind of touched on it. I think this is obviously a projection deal. You're hoping, I mean, he goes from 35 points in 55 games the year, 2 years ago, last year, 75 points. They're projecting this guy's a 100-point player. They're paying him like he's going to be a 100-point player. I don't have any concern he's going to be a scorer. I mean, this guy flies. He's one of the best skaters in the league. To me, what's interesting is, and Michael touched on it with David Perron leaving, Kyrou's been kind of sheltered. He is a scorer, but when he's not great defensively, pop him down to the third line. It kind of reminds me of like what Alex Tuch was here in Vegas for listeners in Vegas. Like, spectacular dynamic player that can break the game open, but you don't have to count on him for defensive zone starts and stuff like that. Well, now that you're paying him $8 million a year, that responsibility is going to go up. And like, I have no doubt that he can handle it. But that's the interesting part to me. I'm not worried about his production. I'm worried, or I'm just curious to see, can he be a top six player? Tough minutes. David, like Michael said, David Perron leaving is going to put him in higher pressure situations. Going to have to play 200-foot game. I really like his game. Him and Robert Thomas, I mean, they've got two really, really good players that are super young. I think Robert Thomas is even younger than Kyrou, locked up for the next 8 years. If they're both great, these will be value deals and the Blues will be in good shape. You'll have two players locked up for 8 years. If they aren't great, they're going to be in trouble. But so far they're projecting to be, I mean, I think that they've got their two best players locked up long-term. So good for the Blues overall.
They're world junior teammates as well. That picture has been floating around of them winning at the world juniors. But now I guess you look at what the Blues have. They have O'Reilly and Tarasenko heading into UFA. They've only got six forwards signed for the 2023-24 season, excuse me. So I love the salary cap era because as soon as you kind of check things off your to-do list, the to-do list just keeps getting longer and longer. So
What do you guys think of the whole 8-year deal thing right now? It's, you know, more from a player perspective, I think it's down goes Brown that's tweeted about this a couple times that he's just stunned that players would be able in a league where the cap is starting in 2025 is supposed to skyrocket, would be willing to, you know, take these type of deals that if, you know, as Dom wrote, Kyrou, if he projects out to what his models say, this is going to be an absolute steal for them.
Yeah, I think it's a little short-sighted, but I think the players have seen these last couple of years, the cap hasn't gone up. It's almost hard to imagine the salaries all going up. You're seeing veterans like Phil Kessel signs for $2 million. There have been quite a few veterans that sign. It feels like there's not much money to go around. And I just feel like it's when you're in that environment over the last couple of years where things are so tight, it's hard to think, well, these contracts are going to be worth way more in 4 years or whatever. So I get it, like what they're doing. Like, I want my money. Let's get it now. The money's been hard to come by. Let me get my 8-year deal and be my family secured. Yep. But I do agree with you, Michael. It does seem a bit short-sighted.
$65 million. You see that, you know, we're talking about the eight, they're looking at the 65. And when you see that number, it's especially for a 23-year-old, I could see the allure of saying, like you said, give me my money now.
Yep. Do you guys remember Darcy Hordachuk, longtime NHLer? He was a bit of a bruiser, played for Atlanta and Florida. I remember having a conversation with him during the lockout in 2004, and we were talking about the salary cap era, and he was totally against it and all that type of stuff. And I remember having this conversation. He was totally for, you know, the cap and all that type of thing, if I remember correctly. And I remember having this conversation with him about how the problem with the cap is that the big time stars are still going to get their money. And it's going to be the little guy that's still squeezed out or the middle guy. Yep. And that is exactly what's happened. As Jesse mentioned, I mean, have you ever seen so many good players that are just still unemployed? I mean, Evan Rodriguez just had a sign for $2 million. Zach Aston-Reese, who's had a pretty good year last year, had to just sign a PTO. It feels like this cap era right now with teams out of money is proving exactly what I thought it was going to happen, you know, 15 years ago, 17 years ago, is that the guys still are going to get their money that are the superstars in the league or the elite scorers, but it's still the middle guys and the below guys are going to get squeezed.
It's kind of like pretty much every other industry, isn't it?
Yeah.
All the CEOs get all the money and everyone else are the ones that get squeezed. Let's move on to Montreal, guys. They continue doing very un-Montreal type things. Nick Suzuki announced as the youngest captain in Habs history, 31st captain in history, 23 years old, all of 209 games played in the NHL. I said very un-Habs because you look at what they've done over the last couple of years. I mean, Marty St. Louis was coaching Bantam Hockey and suddenly he's the head coach of the Montreal Canadiens. You've got just everything seems to be different with this culture. They don't want to be, you know, and you don't want, while still respecting the history of Le Canadien de Montréal, very un-Canadian-like. But I have not heard one negative thing from teammates or anyone about Nick Suzuki. So to me, this seems like, you know what? Go for it. Jesse, what'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, he's super young. I actually got to deal with Nick Suzuki quite a bit. Obviously, the Golden Knights drafted him in the first round. And when I was dealing with Nick Suzuki, he was like 17, 18 years old. And I can remember talking to him in the locker room in Vegas. And I'm like, wow, he seems like he's like 28 years old. Like he is so mature for his age. Just the way he handles the media, the way he talks, the way he interacts with his teammates. He just seems way older than he actually is. So I do think that if there is a kid out there that is that age, that is able to handle the pressure of being the captain of the Montreal Canadiens, I think Nick Suzuki, just from a personality standpoint, is the guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've been hearing rumors about this for a long, long time. And I read, you know, Arpon and Marc-Antoine's story yesterday, and it felt like Shea Weber basically told him months ago that he was going to be the next captain, and he just, like, you know, accepted it. And I thought it was fascinating that Martin St. Louis talked to him earlier this summer and asked him if he would consider this. And he actually took a couple months to really think it over. I don't think he was obviously whoever was going to turn it down, but just the fact that he really absorbed this and this was kept under the bag for a long, long time, I think is pretty fascinating. And, you know, every time I watch this kid, he looks like he's going to be an absolute stud. You know, as Jesse said, he just, when he's in front of the media and he just watching his press conferences at the golf course yesterday, he just seems to have this real confidence about on this aura. And I can't wait. I mean, talk about a really cool 48 hours. He gets to go from being named captain of the Canadiens to out to the NHL media tour to talk to all the rights holders and things like that. So we'll see him out where it started for him in Vegas in the next couple of days.
It's funny. They make a 23-year-old the captain of the Montreal Canadiens. No complaints. Little RBC logo on the Montreal Canadiens jersey. And people lose their minds. I mean, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, Jesse, and I know, Michael, it's your first show, but it was going to happen. We have to stop bitching and moaning about it. It's not going to turn into European hockey, yep. But it's so funny. Like, really, you can debate whether or not a 23-year-old is ready to be a captain in the NHL, because a captain is not, this isn't men's league where a captain's responsibility is basically make sure we have beer after the game. There's a lot of responsibilities that maybe people don't know come with being the captain of an NHL team. And I remember when 24/7 first started and seeing how much power is not the right word, but how much influence a captain has.
Yeah.
Even John Tortorella was talking to the team and he said, okay, we're going to head to the bus. And I think it was McDonough or whoever was captain at the time said, what time do you want the guys on the bus? It wasn't Tortorella telling them to be on the bus at a certain time. It was the captain telling them to be there at a certain time. So you can debate whether or not a 23-year-old is ready or not, but I just love that we still are so angry about the RBC logo. that it doesn't match the rest of the colors.
Well, I'll tell you on both points. One, on captaincy, you know, the big thing too in today's day and age is bringing a room together. And a lot of that has to do with off-ice activities. Like, I had lunch with Jake Middleton, a defenseman on the Wild, yesterday, and he was going on and on and on about the stuff that Jared Spurgeon, the Wild's captain, and Foligno and Dumba, the assistant captains, basically do here. And he's like, here we are. We're a week before training camp, and tomorrow is our one off day where we're not having captain's practices. And the three of them have planned all these different activities for all the players that are in town. And that's the type of thing that Suzuki probably, you know, still doesn't know, like, that is now going to be his responsibility. And obviously he'll have a great, you know, I think it's Gallagher and who's the other, the A there. It was Gallagher, I think Edmondson, who's a great, great leader. So he'll have definitely people that'll help him along, but that's pretty, I just think that's one thing that he probably doesn't know comes with the territory. On the patches, by the way, I just think it's fascinating, mostly from the number of teams that still haven't announced if they're having ones. And it's not because they're making this stance like, oh, we don't want it on our jerseys. Nobody's turning down $3 or $4 million in revenue. It's I think there is a huge, huge right now battle to get people to sign up for these things, to get companies to be able to sponsor this, because baseball is also selling theirs for next year. Other sports are doing it as well. So there are teams out there that haven't announced if they're going to have patches. And I think there's going to be, you know, a good number of teams. I'm sitting down with Bill Daly actually tomorrow, and that's one of the topics I want to get to, is how many of these teams do you expect not to have jersey patches this year?
It cracks me up that people are watching a hockey game and there are like a bajillion ads on the boards, on the ice,
everywhere.
The presentation is brought to you by Verizon. It's like everything. And then this tiny little patch, you can't even see it on TV. No, like the helmet, people made a big deal of the helmet logos last year. Like, I forgot they even had logos on their helmets after one game of it. You can barely even see it. It's not that big a deal. Get the player some more money.
It's like, shut up. I saw those complaints. I'm like, again, you can debate whether a 23-year-old should be captain. You can't debate. As Jesse said, you're not even seeing it on TV. But
100%.
Nick Suzuki. Yeah, Nick Suzuki joining quite an illustrious group. You know, you got the Richards, you know, Maurice and Henri. I'm looking at other captains. Beliveau, Cornway, Savard, Gainey, and now Nick Suzuki. All right, we were talking about captains and Tortorella and everything else, so let's get to that topic because John Tortorella did an interview this week. And I'm just going to read you the quote, and I want to hear get your reactions to this because we all know Torts can, well, let's just say he's Torts. Quote, I have major concerns about the locker room. I've spent some time in the office talking to players, talking to personnel, talking to general manager Chuck Fletcher, all the front office. I have major concerns about what goes on there. Before we even step on the ice, situations and standards and accountability in the room is forefront. You can't get squat done on the ice until you get the room straightened out. And I think we have a little bit of work to do there. If you're a Philadelphia Flyer, is that the scariest or greatest quote you've ever heard, Michael?
Well, I think for the winners in that team, the guys that want to win and turn what's been a demoralizing organization around the last couple of years, I think that you're completely uplifted by that because you know also that there are issues in that room. If you're one of those other guys, you're scared to death. And Torts is going to go in there. One, it's a brilliant manipulative move by Torts because he buys himself time now. If they suck, it's the room. The room. But I just think that he's going to go in there and he's going to raise some hell. And, I hope Charlie O'Connor becomes the Larry Brooks there. I think it'll be great theater. No, I'm just kidding. It's.
I think that's what I'm saying, Charlie.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Get the fuck out of here, then.
Yeah. And, just make sure you have your phone on mute before a press conference. But to me, it was typical Torts. He's already setting the stage for what now topics will be in training camp. He gets everything off the ice. It's no longer be about lines and the. Takes pressure off immediately of like guys like Carter Hart, and he's just going to go in there and he's going to tear the room apart. And it's going to be really fascinating to see the marriage that he has with Chuck Fletcher as well. And John's going to go in there and I think have the personality. By the way, just on a totally other subject, Tyler Mott just signed with the Senators, and man, have they had a good offseason.
Yeah, they have. Tortorella, like, I feel like a lot of coaches would come in and see this and talk about it amongst the staff and amongst the management. Like the fact that he's just coming, it's out in the media and he's like, yeah, it's a wreck. We're going to have to fix all this. And like Michael said, that's every question throughout camp is going to be about fixing the room. It's no longer about the hockey. I see it's in it, like, okay, it's good. You're taking the pressure off the hockey. Yeah. Maybe you buy yourself some time, but at the same time, it's like, do you really want the focus to be on how like, screwed up the locker room is?
Yeah,
like, couldn't you have fixed this without telling everyone that it needed to be fixed? I don't know. It's Tortorella, though. He's different. He is his own. He's a rare bird. He does what he wants. And it's just fascinating. I don't think many coaches would want this to be a public discussion of how much of a wreck the room is and how there's no accountability. And we've got to get, like, it's just interesting. That was the first thing I thought when he said it was, wow, like it doesn't shock me that is the case. It shocks me that he's telling us all that.
Yeah. But, the thing with Torts, like, and I love Torts, but probably because I've never had to cover him and I have never had any blowups with him. He's always actually treated me super well. I think everything with him is thought. Like, this didn't just come out, instantaneously, extemporaneously. Like, he wanted this out there. And now he also puts these players in positions in camp where they are going to have to answer uncomfortable questions from the media. And I think that is all part of the thought process of trying to clean whatever he feels are issues up there. And I could tell you from my own sources in Philly, that was a bad room last year. Like, the whining that went on in that room, the negativity that went on in that room, was second to none by some of the people that I've talked to there, and it needs to be cleaned up. And I think that's one of the areas that now look, losing brings that, right? You always have a great room when you're winning, right? Everybody talks about the unbelievable culture in there. I guarantee the Colorado Avalanche have the best culture in the league, right? I mean, that's the way it works.
Vegas players talked a lot about that last year.
Yeah, but they didn't when they had 40 something points. So I'm sure that, look, losing breeds that stuff, but clearly there were issues there. This is not something that John just manufactured. I've heard it as well. And as you all know, I know a lot of people that have been part of that organization the last couple of years. And I just think it is something that he sees as a genuine problem. But for him to bring it up publicly, there was a method to the madness.
I love what Torts does to everybody around him. I haven't covered him on a regular basis, but I remember being at the Outdoor Classic in Philly. And is a press conference, and you guys know this, the press conference is where you have to wait for your microphone. So you're kind of like up there. And I remember going, I've been doing this a long time. I shouldn't be nervous. I was so nervous he was going to yell at me. And it really wasn't even that like controversial of a question. I asked the question and he answered it. And I went, I remember thinking I shouldn't be this nervous, but he just kind of exudes that at times. And that's why I asked if that's a scary situation. We saw what happened with him in Line A. We saw what happened pretty much at every stop. And I don't know about you guys, this sort of feels like, and I don't want to say last chance, like if it doesn't work in Philly, he's done in coaching, but is his style, is his intimidation, is his outgoingness going, on its way out? And maybe this is a last chance for Torts.
Yeah, I think so. Just also based on the fact that he's been at so many different places, but he's still a young man relatively. And he's, you know, there's certain, look at Bruce Boudreau, right? 67 years old in Vancouver, I believe 66, maybe. I don't want to shortchange Bruce there. But you know, like there are certain coaches that still, if a team is in the middle of a season, they're having a struggle, you pull in a guy like Tortorella from the sidelines, from the bullpen, and it'll probably be a jolt. So I don't want to sit there.
Boudreau's mellowed out a bit, though.
Yeah,
right? You can all agree that he's mellowed out a bit. I don't know if Torts was ever going
to
mellow out.
No doubt. But sometimes if you're in a midseason and he's without a job, he'd be the perfect guy to go in there and kick some, you know, tear some paint off the wall and things like that. He does remind me a little bit of when I covered Mike Keenan in Florida. You know, I what you just said, Rob, is something that I do remember. Now, I was a lot younger then, a lot less comfortable in my skin, but I'd still covered the league when I covered Keenan for, you know, basically 6 or 7 years. And I do remember sometimes when I was about to ask him a question that was pointed or critical or things like that, getting just sort of worked up and stressed by how's he going to react. And thank goodness I covered Keenan in a non-YouTube, non-Twitter era, or we would have had a lot of things out in the public eye that Torts has had with other reporters. I mean, trust me.
Yeah.
I think when Rob says he's like, is this his last chance? I don't see it as a, like, I think is this the last chance for his style? Like, can
that's
this style
work? That's what I mean. Like, and that's why I say with Boudreau mellowing out, Boudreau to me seems like he's adapted to the newer style of coaching, where I just don't know if Torts has that gear.
I had a great conversation with Pete DeBoer last year about, because he was getting ready to win his 500th game. And I was talking to him about, like, how different is it from 500 games ago to now, like what you're doing as a coach? And he's like, oh, it's night and day different. Like it used to be like totalitarianism. Like you are the dictator. This is a dictatorship. I tell you what to do. You all do it. The power has shifted to the athletes in every sport. Hockey, maybe the least of the sports. Like in basketball, the players are running the show.
Oh yeah.
in football, it's the quarterbacks are running the show. In hockey, I think the coaches still have maybe a little more power than they do in the others, but it's definitely shifted to a point where a coach cannot just walk into a room and tell these guys exactly what to do and expect to get results. You've got to work with the players. It's a partnership more than a telling you exactly what to do. And I think Tortorella, I'm not saying Tortorella doesn't have partnerships with his players, but I think he does. This if this doesn't work, it's a clear sign that the league may be passing that style by.
Yeah, although I will say this, as to your other point there about how this is the one sport that still allows that hardness. I sat down with Dean Evason for a giant Q&A that'll probably run tomorrow in The Athletic. And, you know, Dean, if you don't know, if you're listening, is the Minnesota Wild coach, and his big style is he is a player's coach. He gives his big thing is I give the room to the players. Dean is very, very rarely in there. He delegates everything to his assistants. He lets the captains run that. Well, the Wild just had their 50th first round exit in a row last year. And now Dean made it extremely clear to me this year, they are going to be harder. This coaching staff and him are going to be harder on these guys this year than they've ever been. So I think, and if anybody knows Dean Evason, he is a hard ass. I mean, this guy was he was a tough, tough hombre when he was a player in the league. Came out of juniors as an unbelievable scorer. Realized quickly when he was behind guys like Ron Francis and Ray Ferraro and in Hartford that he better change his style if he wanted a stick. And he changed into one of the top checking centers in the league. And he's going to come here this year, and I think he's going to try to take the hybrid Torts. And I think that'll be a real awakening for the Minnesota Wild guys. I think that style can still exist, maybe to not Torts' level, but right now he's going to a rebuild situation, a rehabilitation situation, and whatever Torts says in Philadelphia is absolutely going to be the way that it's going to go there, and I think that they need that type of style right now.
Just like the game has evolved, coaching has evolved too. So that's what I'm curious to see what's going to happen in Philly. We're going to take a quick break. After the break, I want to talk to these two illustrious writers. See, I call you guys illustrious. We don't call Jeff illustrious. About headline writing, because I saw a headline this week, guys, that kind of got me saying, what? And then I read it and saw the quote and I thought, Okay. I want to talk to you guys a little bit about clickbait. We're also going to talk about Bo Horvat. We're going to talk about unsigned UFA. So plenty to come. Don't go anywhere.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, segment number two, and the rookie, Michael Russo, already wants to jump over the boards. What's up?
You know what your illustrious comment reminded me of?
Yeah.
You guys watch Seinfeld?
Of course.
So you know the breathtaking episode? Yeah. where like, so I call Jeff Domet illustrious. You now call Jesse and I illustrious. So the breathtaking episode is there's an ugly baby. And well, anyway, so Elaine walks in. There's this doctor there that's looking over a pediatrician. The pediatrician calls Elaine breathtaking. And then there's this ugly baby that the doctor is taking care of. And he calls the baby breathtaking. And Elaine got super offended. She's like, if he's breathtaking, who isn't breathtaking? Yeah. So that's the illustrious reminded me of that. Like, I still think Jeff is illustrious, even though that we're using it now flippantly in the episode.
You gotta see the baby. I'm gonna bring up Seinfeld. You're speaking my language. Guys, I saw this you guys probably are in the same boat. I read whatever I can, and headlines tend to catch my attention. I saw a headline that says, Connor McDavid said Oilers still have a long way to go. And I went, did he really say that? And I thought, you know, when I hear that, I don't know about you guys. If someone says we have a long way to go, that's, hey, we're rebuilding, give us 5 years, and, you know, we're going to be a competitive hockey team. And I thought, he couldn't have said that. And then I went and watched, you know, the presser, and I read the entire quote. And he said, he was comparing it to 2017, and basically said, well, we only won one more game than we did in 2017. So it feels like we're closer last year than the previous year, but we want to win. We still have a long way to go to get that, which means we still have a whole other series to win. Stop comparing. You guys are both writers. I want to know, do you write your own headlines, or have you ever had issues with someone writing a headline to say, you know what, my piece has nothing to do with that, or that's misrepresenting? Because let's face it, we're in an industry where clicks equal money. You want people to click. I understand how it works. But to me, I kind of felt like I was duped on that one. Russo, we'll start with you.
Well, anybody that knows my story, so I've been a sports writer since I was 15. I started at the Sun Sentinel, was there forever, and then wound up at the Star Tribune for 12 years. And so the general rule with newspapers is that you don't write your own headlines, because also when you're filing a story at the Gun after a game, you don't know where it's going in the paper. You know, you don't know what the size, you know, where it's going to fit. So editors do that. I've kept up at the Athletic. I don't know what Jesse's style is. I very rarely write my own headline. Sometimes I will put a suggested headline. My editor, personal editor, Jake Leonard, which I don't think, Jesse, you have. Jake's unbelievable. One, he's an unbelievable headline writer. But two, what I love about Jake is that he'll read my story and he'll actually send me three or four, like, which of these headlines do you like the most? And nice. Let me be collaborative in saying, yes, that's the way I would do it. And so I feel like, you know, now if there's a headline on my story and I feel it's not exactly what I wrote or it's too clickbaitish, well, now I'm responsible for it as well. And so I think Jake does an incredible job at that. But I personally let the editors write the headline, especially after games. Jesse, I don't know your style. I let them do it. A lot of times if I can't think of something, if it is a column, I try to give them a suggestion.
Yeah, I do pretty much almost exactly the same thing. I'll usually write something in the headline box on the story, but my editor, Rich Hammond, he's awesome. Also, he's so good at writing headlines that I tell even when I file to like just a random editor, I'm like, hey, I hate my headline writing. If you think of something better, replace it. I rely on the editor heavily, and Rich will do the same thing. He'll send me a couple and say like, okay, this one's a little more aggressive of a headline. This one's a little tame. Would like which one do you have? Which one fits the feel that you want this story to have? When Rob said, have you ever had a headline that got you in trouble? It took me back. So when I first started in journalism when I was still in college. I was an intern at the Las Vegas Sun, and I was doing like crime stories, like, oh, there was a car accident on this intersection or whatever. And I had an editor, I wrote a story one time, and like, this is not a story where you're indulging, like, it's literally just the facts from the police report that you're writing. And I wrote this story about a car accident, and the editor wrote, elderly person in car accident, blah, blah, blah. The person was only like 55. And I got like 10 calls to my office phone of people that were in their 50s saying, I cannot believe you would call this person elderly. I'm 60 and I am not an elderly person. They were furious. It's the most upset I've ever had anyone at a story I've ever written. And it was just because the word elderly in the headline.
The headline writer was probably about 25 when he wrote it. Because don't you remember, like, when I was young, I used to think people my age were older than crap. And now it's like, I'm that age. And it's like, holy, I'm not 55 yet. But you know, I will say like just to, you know, one thing, like I wrote this Brock Besser story the other day, my headline Besser, that was it. All I put in the headline field, and I let Jake take it from there. And Jake wrote the perfect headline for that story. But I have the most mad Brian Murray ever has been with me was, and I can't remember what the headline was, but it had to do with, we were in Hull, Quebec for training camp, and that was back pre like internet. And he had literally a photocopy of an article that I appeared that day that I had not even seen. And the headline was so off the map of what I wrote. And actually the copy editor got in trouble for it because it was so not what I wrote. But regardless, Brian didn't even read the article. He was just so pissed at the headline. And you know, that's always my excuse. Yeah, I always throw the editor under the bus. Sorry, I don't write my own headlines. So,
well, it's funny now, like, you know, I bring this up because you guys are writers, but nowadays, you know, I do a lot of videos that are digital videos. And so that you're looking for a grabby title. And sometimes that happens, especially if it's a question. You know what I mean? If the question is, you know, is Alexander Ovechkin the greatest goal scorer ever? Even if I say yes or no in the video, people will automatically just start commenting that you're wrong. And you're like, well, you clearly didn't watch it. And that one kind of got me. Maybe I'm making a mountain out of a molehill here, guys. But I just, to me, that headline screams of like, hey, guys, be patient. In 5 years, we'll win the cup. And yeah, I don't think Oiler fans are ready for another 5-year wait. No. So I wanted to ask you guys about that. Let's move on to Vancouver. Because Bo Horvat made a headline himself saying he wants to be a Canuck for life. 27, he's entering his final year of that 6-year, $33 million deal. He said, quote, obviously my career started here and my wife and I love the city. We love the people. We love the fans, the organization. So you always have that in the back of your mind that you want to be a Canuck for life. Yay or nay, does it happen? Jesse?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, the Canucks aren't in the best cap situation, but I do think that, I mean, he just had his best season. I mean, he's 26, so it's not like he's still developing, but 31 goals last year, first time he broke that 30-goal mark in his career. I thought he was one of the better players on that team. I thought he was a big part of the reason they turned things around. Obviously, Boudreau is a big part. I think I thought watching Canucks games down the stretch, he was one of, if not the best players on the ice. So, like, I definitely think that they're interested in signing him. You never know. Like, I think he's going to get one more contract. Will he want another one after that? Like, who knows? I don't know if he's going to be a Canuck. It's tough to predict that far, but I do think he gets a contract. If I'm the Canucks, I want him back. What about you, Michael?
Yeah, I agree. First of all, who wouldn't want to be in Vancouver for life? He probably has got awesome. A giant shack looking over the harbor there. You know, or as I joke with Brock Besser recently, like, you know, I think anybody that has like a giant penthouse overlooking that water would, like, there's something about landing in Vancouver. Like, usually when I leave Edmonton, I'm in the worst mood. And then when I land in Vancouver and I look out the windows, I'm just like in the greatest mood. There's something about that city that I would want to live there for life as well. But in terms of the organization, they've got some work to do to clean things up there. But I could tell you, Boudreau absolutely loves Horvat. I love Horvat as a player. As Jesse just said, he's, you know, this is a 26, 27 year old player that plays up the middle. That's as good as there gets in the league. It feels like he's been in the league forever. He's only getting better. And if I could build around somebody like that, I just think that I can. And now that JT's signed and, you know, Besser for what, 3 more years, I think he just signed for. If they could make it work, I think they'll try. Their cap situation needs to be improved. They've got it. figure out a way to improve their blue line big time. And so I think that is going to be a priority there for Patrick Allvin and Jim Rutherford.
Speaking of signing, the laundry list of players who are still UFAs is pretty interesting to me on, what is it, September 14th. Yep. You got Anton Stralman, you got Victor Rask, you got Sandy Milano, Andy Green, Chason, Brian Boyle. But P.K. Subban is still out there, guys. And I know we've seen P.K. Subban's offensive production, we'll call it, dive off. And I've always said his offense always covered up his defensive liabilities. So, you know, who's going to want him now? But I really didn't think we'd be sitting on September 14th and P.K. Subban still doesn't have a hockey team to play for. Any teams you're hearing? I mean, I think a Montreal reunion would be fun, but I don't know about you guys. What do you think of Subban still waiting on the sidelines? Jesse?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a case of like how many teams entered this offseason over the cap? Half of them. At one point, it was like half the teams in the league are over the cap. And it's a combination of that with these veteran players. It's hard for them to take a deal that's less when you've been making X amount, even if maybe my plays declined, but it's still in their mind, it's like, well, I'm not a $1 million player. Come on.
Yeah.
And just the Golden Knights signed Phil Kessel for very little money. And hearing Phil Kessel talk, it's like, yeah, I feel like the league has forgotten about me. I signed this 1 year deal. It's a prove it. Like in his mind, yeah, I'm making $2 million, but next year I'm going to be making $6 million because that's the level of player I am. I think it's hard for these veterans that have been making good money for X amount. It's not even the actual money in their bank account. It's the number next to their name. I am worth more than that.
It's an
I think
ego
it's hard.
Thing, right? Ego,
yes, yeah. It's hard. So to me, that's why there are so many guys out there unsigned. The combination of the how screwed the cap up is league wide and the fact that these guys. They don't want to sign for a deal like that. They're going to eventually have to, or they're going to be signing PTOs. Michael, what have you heard?
Yeah, one thing also I would say that I am sure that PK is weighing is that if there has been interest in him, if he's going to sign that 1 year deal at $1.5-2 million, it's going to have to be on a cup contender. And the cup contenders in the league, the teams that are considered it, you know, Tampa, Carolina, I mean, Colorado is not at the cap, but they are obviously preparing, you know, a 1 year deal they could probably do, but they're preparing to sign McKinnon, you know, they're giving some big time contracts away. I'm sure that he's just, you know, also he's not going to go sign a 1 year deal with a bottom feeder. You know, he's just not going to do that. So, you know, frankly, if he's going to want, you know, a long-term deal, it might be with ESPN or something, you know, that could be what's coming down the pike for him. You know, I'm sure NHL Network would want him, but you know, NHL Network, I think the feeling is that NHL Network doesn't pay a ton. You know, I could see him, he did some work with ESPN in the past. If this is it for PK, I could see him on TV very, very soon.
Yeah, he's been grooming himself for that sort of thing. Like I always feel like he knows what he wants to do post-hockey, but we'll have to see. And speaking of post-hockey, I mean, there are a lot of players still out there that not necessarily, we know they're actively looking, and we still don't know what their intentions are. The Joe Thorntons of the world, the Zdeno Charas of the world, Corey Schneider, Braden Holtby. I wonder what kind of goes into that stage of your career, like a Joe Thornton. You know what I mean? Where do I want another? Do I want that one more shot or do I want to just ride off into the sunset? Could you see any of these guys doing the riding off into the sunset, Michael?
I could. I mean, the problem is the longer it gets that you're without a deal when you're that age, the less motivation you have to continue to work out and skate and things like that. So that's the big thing is what, you know, I actually feel bad that I've had so many conversations with Joe Resnick, his agent, in the last couple of days, and I haven't even brought up Joe Thornton, you know, but I've been talking to him about for my Jake Middleton story and things like that. And I haven't even asked him about Joe, but I bet you Joe is sort of in the similar boat as PK is that if he does want to continue, it's going to have to be on a cup contender. You know, he's not going to go sign 1 year in Arizona, I don't think. You know, maybe he would. But I think that's the type of situation he is. Obviously, he was, you know, not a big part of that Florida Panther team last year. And I'm sure that's weighing on him. And it's tough when these guys get to a certain age. Eric Staal's going down to Florida on a PTO. They just, you know, they're such lifers that they don't want to give it up. But they also, you know, don't want to be in a position where they're just going to, you know, just sign 1 year at a cheap deal. So I don't know what's going to happen with Holtby. I think he's dealing with some injury issues, you know, things like that. Char was at Boston. He just showed up at the Bruins training camp yesterday, their facility. And apparently, according to the reports, there's nothing really happening right there in terms of contract with the Bruins. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with some of these big names that are, you know, in some cases, future Hall of Famers.
I wonder if this could like go into the season, like a contender that's at the cap right now that doesn't really have a spot in the lineup. That's like, and then a week into the season, your left wing goes down and it's like, oh, we've got $4 million on LTIR yeah. that we didn't think we had. Joe Thornton's sitting there. We didn't want you 3 weeks ago, but maybe now we need you and we've yeah. got the cap space. Like, I wonder if, like you said, they want to be on contenders. Most of the contenders are pressed to the cap as tightly as they yeah. can be. And they're settled right now. They're happy with what they have, but this is hockey.
Yeah.
What you have right now, you're not going to have in a month.
Yep. So, but along with what Michael said yeah. is keeping it when you get to that, yeah. I'm not going to call them. What did you get in trouble for calling the elderly? I'm yeah. not going to yeah. call them elderly, but I will say at an advanced age, as Michael yeah. said, staying in NHL shape when not playing NHL hockey is very difficult. Yeah, so
not easy.
I'm not sure the Thorns of the world are like, yeah, give me a call in November, December if somebody goes down.
And it's just finding those right skates too. Like I've covered, you know, guys, I think Mark Parrish here in Minnesota, where he was without a contract and he was skating every day and into it and things like that. And all of a sudden when all these guys left for NHL training camps, now he had almost nobody to skate with to keep him up to that yep. par. So I think the only thing that, like, I think if what Jesse said is true and these guys actually might have options that they can't say publicly yet, or there's an opportunity out there that they're talking about, I think that at some point we'll see them sign PTOs just so they can get to whether it's that team that's plans to sign them or any NHL team that's, you know, because again, a PTO, you're still a free agent, you can sign anywhere. I think that you would see these guys sign those PTOs just to get into an NHL training camp, keep in shape, and then eventually a deal comes down the pike. The fact that hasn't been announced yet makes me think that they really don't have any options, at least as far as now, or haven't made a decision about what their future is.
Or they're on a treadmill somewhere, just yeah. trying to stay in NHL shape. Before we go to break, guys, Black Ice is going to be premiering at the Toronto International Film Festival on Saturday. It's directed by Oscar nominee Hubert Davis, executive produced by LeBron, Drake, and Maverick Carter, and it examines the role of black players in Canadian hockey, obviously the good, the bad, and the ugly. I haven't had a chance to obviously see it because the premiere's on Saturday. I don't know if you guys got those cool advanced copies that sometimes we get. But we're seeing a lot of people involved in this, and I'm really curious to see not only the actual film, but you know what kind of impact it'll have across hockey. What about you guys?
Yeah, I you know, I also haven't seen it. Haven't gotten sent you know, a lot of times we'll get sent documentary yeah. previews and things like that. I haven't seen it, so I'm a little concerned to talk about it just because, you know, from a sophisticated standpoint, because I'm not exactly sure what's in it. But when you were talking about it, the first thing I think about is Peter Worrell. Like, I covered him for a long time in Florida, and the stuff that he dealt with when he was playing in Canadian juniors was just deplorable. And so I'm interested to see if that's where this documentary is going or things like that. But I just think it's going to be a fascinating doc and I can't wait to watch it.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I'm excited to see it. Hopefully they do a good job of I guess, like, I feel like we hear so much about Jackie Robinson, and in other sports, this has been fleshed out a lot more. In hockey, it's almost like, I mean, we cover the sport and I think there's a lot we can learn from this documentary. So I think it's a topic that if they do it well and do it right, this is going to be an awesome documentary that can open a lot of people's eyes to things that maybe they didn't hear before.
Like I said, premiering at the Toronto International Film Festival on Saturday. We're going to take one more break. And after the break, want to talk about the piece that Michael's been alluding to a couple times during this podcast, his piece on Brock Besser. He said that he submitted a headline that said Besser. Well, it ended up being "My Dream is His Dream. Canucks Brock Besser turns focus to hockey after a year of pain and loss." So that's a good headline. Got me to click on it. We'll talk about that after the break.
No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. Whether you're sending emails or writing a Slack message, the last thing you want is a grammatical error. It just looks unprofessional. Just a little bit of help from Grammarly can make a big impact on your work day to day. 96% of Grammarly users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. It works across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, tone suggestions help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Save time with one click and go from editing drafts in hours to seconds. 93% of professionals using Grammarly Premium report that it helps them get more work done. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Okay, so this is usually the point, Michael. I know you're new here, where we talk about what you guys are working on, and we will talk about that in just a second, but I want to go backwards first. As I mentioned in the previous segment, you wrote your piece on Brock Besser and dealing with, as the headline said, pain and loss. He had a very ill father, and he was trying to be an NHL player while trying to be there for his dad, Duke, and his family. I certainly don't want to make this about myself. Mm-hmm. But I've never had a story hit me more personally. This is a story about a man who was diagnosed with lung cancer, beat it. It came back and he unfortunately passed away at a very young age. That's exactly what I've gone through literally to a T with my father over the last year. We just lost him almost exactly a year ago. I'm not embarrassed to say that this story got me choked up. It got me thinking. It also got me thinking, guys, about, you know, what have we spent this whole podcast talking about? Well, he's a $5 million player. He's a $2 million player. Well, he scored this many goals. He did that. And Brock Besser got a lot of shit last year at times where he wasn't producing. And you read something like that. And again, like, I've never played in the NHL and I never will, but I remember debating whether to go to Tokyo for the Olympics because my dad was so sick. I ultimately chose to stay home with my father and be there in his last days. So I don't know how Brock Besser even showed up to hockey going through all that. But first off, fantastically written. Great, great piece, Michael. But like, have you been wanting to do this for a while? Was this something that just kind of came across, or break this down a bit for us?
Yeah. I mean, I have a relationship with Brock and his mom for a long, long time. I've, you know, as Thomas Trance and Harmon Dale joke, I'm sort of the Brock Besser beat writer at The Athletic. I first sat down with Brock the year of his draft at a Caribou in Burnsville, Minnesota, and he and I just sort of hit it off right away. And so we've always had this good relationship. Knew Duke, you know, really, really well, and his mom, because I've just written so many stories about them, and he was as strong a person as I've ever met in my life. So when he died in May, obviously I reached out to them and you know, sent my condolences, but it was one of those things where in the back of my mind, I knew that in the summer before Brock left for Vancouver, I was going to reach out to him and see if he wanted to sit down and do this story, in a large part, not just because of the loss of Duke and to honor him, but because, you know, it really hit me what you just said about just the crap that he took last year and the fact that, you know, he had 23 goals in what was deemed a bad year. I mean, that's usually a great year for a lot of players. And the fact that now he will, for the first time, not have this stress on him. Obviously, he's dealing with the loss and mourning and things like that. But he will now be able to, with clear minds, go to training camp and try to get back to the player that I know that he thinks that he is. And so I reached out to him and he wrote me back right away and said, yeah, let's meet late in August. And we sat down at another Caribou, and it was as gripping an interview as I've ever had. And you're right, Rob. I mean, it brings me back to when my stepfather was dying as well. And I think one thing that, you know, about what you were saying about your dad and my stepdad and Duke with Brock is that the really cool parts of all of our dads was that they got to see us have success. You know, Duke lived there and witnessed him win the national championship, be drafted, be NHL All-Star, you know, MVP in Tampa, you know, score 20 goals every year. And your dad got to see your unbelievable success in the multimedia world. And my stepdad really is a big reason why I'm a sports writer. You know, my only regret is he never saw me get to The Athletic, because I know he'd be super proud. And so this conversation I had with Brock was as gripping. You know, there were tears shed during the conversation because I knew Duke so well. And I do hope, you know, that people read this story, not just if you're a hockey fan, because I think anybody that's dealt with loss or anybody that has an incredible relationship with their dad, I think will absolutely relate to this story. You don't have to just be a sports fan to know it, because what it is about a human being that's dealing with loss, about his hero leaving.
Excellent piece, as always, with Michael. I think few writers in this profession get people to open up the way you do, and the way he did in that piece. Just really, really good piece. I'm lucky to not have dealt with that type of tragedy, but I'm very close with my dad, and it hit home for me too. It was a great piece, Michael.
Oh, thank you so much.
I think we need a shot in the arm like this sometimes to remember that they're players and they're humans. You know.
Yeah.
No doubt.
And I'm guilty of it. How many times? Oh, this guy's playing terrible. He hasn't scored in 10 games. Yep. What's going on? And again, not to make this about myself, but I remember when I was debating whether to go to Tokyo or not, and talking to a few people, and they said, "Your brain is going to be over here, and your body's going to be on the other side of the planet." And I remember thinking, there's no point for me. I have to be here with my family. I'm going to suck, trying to report at the Olympics. He somehow got through it and did it, maybe not to the standards that other people thought Brock Besser should have, like you said, an off year or a bad year. But when you see what he was going through with his father, and guys, go read the piece because, even his last times being able to see his son on the ice and shooting pucks at him from the bench and, again,
yeah,
onions in the room. I'll put it that way. I got emotional.
Yeah, Rob, you mentioned like how this all came about. I'll be honest. I will say, so I was with Duke and Lori and a couple caregivers that are friends with Lori that were there with Ben Hankinson at that morning skate that I paint that scene of in the story where Brock is not only flipping pucks to his dad but really staring longingly, and you could see in Brock's eyes and his head that he was looking and saying, "This is the last time my dad's going to see me on the ice in person." And I was standing there and I was thinking to myself right then, I'm like, I cannot believe what I'm witnessing right now. And I knew right then that if I had ever told the story after Duke passed away, that scene would be in it, because I'm not kidding. As I was watching Brock at the end of this morning skate here in Minnesota, just staring at his dad for honestly 3 minutes and with the most glum look on his face, I had to step away from Duke because I honestly almost broke down, because I knew exactly what Brock was thinking at that point. And I, Duke was the most gentle soul that you could ever imagine, just the nicest human being, always a smile on his face, proud of Brock. And, and I'm proud that I was one able to tell the story, but that Brock felt so comfortable to open up to me. It really reminded me of when I wrote the story when JP Parisi was dying and Zach was able to, sit down with me and essentially cry on my shoulder about it. And I wrote that really lovely piece about his dad while he was still passed. And then again, after he passed. And, there is something about, we're sports writers and we have to be critical of these guys on the ice, but we have to always remember that they're human beings. And I think that most players, I was sitting with Jake Middleton yesterday and I was telling him about my style and how I'm super honest and I'm super objective during games. And I will not, if he turns a puck over for a losing goal, I'm going to have to write it. But if he scores the winning goal, I'm going to have to write it. But when it comes to human beings, I absolutely respect these guys and want to tell, really good personality profiles. And in this case, honestly, a sad story. And I think when you have that respect factor with the players that you cover, that's when you get them to be willing to open up and talk to you about stuff like this. And I do think, not that I'm a model for other reporters, but I think it's a lesson for reporters that you can tell these stories if you treat them fairly throughout a season. And, that's probably my biggest strength, is getting guys, when you sit down with them, to just, talk and feel comfortable.
It's tough. It's tough to do. And you did it very, very well. So make sure to go give that a read. So we're going to talk about what you guys are up to, and we're all in different cities right now, but come next week, you guys are going to be in the same city. What's going on in Vegas?
Actually, come today, I'm going to be in the same city with Jesse. So Jesse's covered the Vegas Golden Knights. I know that he's rookie camp and things like that. Sean Gentile and I are heading out to Vegas today to do the NHL media tour, the car wash. It's the first time that both him and I are getting to do this. And the list of players that we get over the next 2 days are insane. I mean, it's guys like Swayman, Zegras, Ottinger, Barzell, McDavid, McKinnon, McCarr, Stone, Kemper, Eichel, Huberto, the Kachucks, the Hugheses, Vasilevsky. I mean, the list of guys is unbelievable. Roman Josi, Morgan Riley. It's just a crazy list of players, and it's going to be long days. But can't wait to write this. I mean, we're going to go out there. Obviously, if there's news during these little 15-minute gatherings that we get with these players, we'll write that. But a lot of it is also working ahead. Hopefully on Monday, Sean and I will co-author a really cool, fun, meaty story about some of the things that are said and the color of what these guys were talking about during this. We have some big picture stories that we're working on as well that we're going to throw topics. And so, this is one of those stories where you might see some live, but a lot of it, all of a sudden, a month from now, something might pop up that we gather from this.
Jesse, you got something, you're going there with, you know, a goal in mind to work on a specific story, or are you going the same approach as Michael?
No, I'm actually going to be covering rookie camp. I think we've got the national side covered. I'm kind of just being the beat writer this week. It's the players are back in town. I'm going to be doing stuff with the rookies who are going to be on the ice, but also, more importantly, the big club players, the NHL guys, that their camp doesn't start until next week. But, this is the kind of a chance to get some preview stuff for that. It's been a while since I've gotten to talk to these guys. So I'm excited to get back to telling some Golden Knights stories.
One other story that I will tease out there without giving everything away is that we're doing a really cool project at The Athletic that I don't want to divulge because I don't think it's been announced yet. But I think it kicks off October 11th, and the first person that is going to be featured in this thing is Marc-Andre Fleury. And I got to sit down at Mark's house north of Montreal during the draft. I was with him for a couple hours. As Jesse knows, Mark is the nicest human being ever, and could not have been more hospitable to me. I walk in his house and he's like, "Oh, you want me to make you a sandwich?" You know, he's pouring us San Pellegrinos and all this stuff. And then we go sit out on his back patio, which overlooks the St. Lawrence Seaway, and you're watching these cargo ships that, you know, say Superior, Minnesota, and you realize you're in Montreal and these ships came from Minnesota. You know, it was an incredible experience. And so that'll be a really cool story that I believe kicks off October 11th, and it'll kick off a project that everybody will soon learn about at The Athletic.
Be sure to tune in for that. Show number one in the books, boys. I think it was a good one. I'm not going to be here next week, so you guys are on your own from Vegas. So we'll see you in a couple of weeks. But before we go, guys, I want to let everyone know, as I do each and every week, follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget, leave a rating and a review. You get an annual subscription to The Athletic right now for just $1 a month for 6 months when you visit theathletic.com/hockeyshow. The Athletic Hockey Show returns on Thursday with Ian Mendez and Down Goes Brown. For Russo and Granger, I'm Rob Pizzo. We'll be back next week.